is a live view of the Artemis II rocket and spacecraft at the launch pad at NASA's Kennedy Space Center in Florida. Today, we'll discuss how progress towards launch and the mission are going. Welcome, and thank you for joining us today. I'm Rachel Kraft with NASA Communications, and I'm joined this afternoon by several NASA managers to talk to you today about how our progress towards launch are going. They are Dr. Lori Glaze, Acting Associate Administrator for NASA's Exploration Systems Development Mission Directorate, Sean Quinn, Exploration Ground Systems Program Manager, Chris Cianciola, Deputy Program Manager for the SLS Program, and Howard Hugh, Orion Program Manager. We'll have some opening remarks from each of our participants today, and then we'll take questions both from reporters here in the room and those on the phone. For those who are joining us by phone today, a reminder that you can join the question queue by pressing star one. And with that, we'll start with Lori.
Great. Thank you so much, Rachel. And thank you to everyone that's tuned in and here today for helping us share in this incredible excitement of the Artemis II launch. We are getting very, very close, and we are ready. We held our flight readiness review a couple weeks ago, and since that time, all of our operations have been going very smoothly. It's been going very well. Our flight systems are ready. The ground systems are ready. Our launch and operations teams are ready. And our flight operations team in Houston are also ready. The crew arrived yesterday. And I know that they're ready. They are more than ready. They can't wait to get off the ground. It was really terrific to see them, to see the crew arrive in Florida, where they'll be spending the next few days doing their final reviews of their procedures and spending some time with their families while they remain in quarantine. Tomorrow, our mission management team will become the primary decision makers regarding our readiness for launch. The team, the MMT team, will be meeting in the afternoon tomorrow to review the closure plan for the few open work items that came out of the flight readiness review to help ensure that we're ready to go. Before we go on today, I did want to just pause and take a moment to make sure I thank all of the personnel who have put in thousands of hours of work over the last few months, including nights, weekends, holidays, to get us to this point. Without them and their incredible dedication to this mission, we wouldn't be here today. I also want to thank our program managers that are with us here. They have been overseeing a tremendous amount of work within their teams to prepare for Artemis II, but not only to prepare the hardware and the personnel for Artemis II, but they're now also at the same time helping to ensure that we're ready for the increased cadence of the Artemis missions that are to come, and so that we are ready for this increased cadence and the new flights that will begin in next year. And with that, I'm going to pass it over to Sean Quinn for EGS.
Thank you very much, Lori. Well, first of all, it's great to see everyone. I appreciate all your interest in what we do. This week has already started to be an incredible week with the arrival of our Artemis II flight crew. You know, as they were pulling up into the airplanes, we could actually see the moon in the daylight. And it was just, it was really, really cool. Yesterday, we had an important meeting, our launch countdown pretest briefing. This is like the last step before we get into the actual launch countdown, which will start tomorrow afternoon. And I will tell you that it was one of the cleanest launch countdown pretest briefings we've ever had. And Charlie Blackwell Thompson, our launch director, commented to me that, in all the years that she participated in shuttle launch countdowns, they've never had one that was as clean as this one, meaning we had no significant open work. All of our nonconformances were closed, and the team and the ground systems are absolutely ready to get in the launch countdown. The one thing we are watching is the weather, and we got our latest forecast from the launch weather officer from Space Launch Delta 45, and the thing we're watching is cumulus clouds, the thick cloud rule, and also winds. So right now we're forecast to be 80% go on Wednesday afternoon, so that's good. So the last time we met, we said, hey, we need to get out to the pad around the 19th, and we did. We held the schedule, and it was the shortest pad turnaround we've ever had, or pad to VAB to pad turnaround time we've ever had. It was 21 days. Our previous record was probably around 39 or 40. In that time, we not only changed the batteries out on our flight termination system, but we also made two repairs with the helium QD we talked about last time, and also a harness on the flight termination system. Since that time at the pad, we've extended our crew access arm. We've installed our emergency egress systems. We've installed extensible columns on the base of the mobile launcher, and we've retracted our engine service platform. Our launch countdown teams, you know, today was, interestingly enough, was planned to be a weather day. And turns out the weather was not so good today. Well, since we were so far ahead in all of our launch countdown preps, we were able to give the team some time off today, and they've taken advantage of that. Getting into launch countdown, we've checked out our cryo systems, our LH2 and LOX systems, and all those tests have passed. We've done radio frequency tests with our launch vehicle and the spacecraft, and that went very well. And so we're really ready. We're going to start our launch countdown around 3 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. We'll finish some pad washdowns, some mobile launcher washdowns, and we'll get on with it. So at this point, we can safely say the crew's ready, the rocket's ready, the spaceship's ready, ground systems are ready, and we only need to have the weather to cooperate on Thursday, and we're ready to go. So with that, I'll turn it over to CeCe.
All right, Sean, thank you. We, too, are incredibly excited to be here. This is our first opportunity to launch humans to deep space in more than 53 years. You think about that. The last mission completed for humans in deep space in December of 1972. I do appreciate your interest, and I'm happy to be here to represent the SLS program on behalf of Manager David Beeman and the entire SLS team. Our teams are working hard to get the rocket ready. You've heard Sean talk about all the work that's gone over in the last 3 or 4 weeks, but the energy and dedication of the team is truly electric. Everybody's excited. Now, we all recognize the historical significance of this mission, but our teams are still focused on making sure the rocket is fully prepared and ready to go. That is our focus. Since the rollout was complete on the 20th, the teams have worked to make sure that the connections to the ML and the pad infrastructure are all correct. The vehicle is talking to the pad, it's talking to the systems, and everything is coming along good. And like Sean said, everything seems to be going well between the vehicle and the pad. We have completed all our ordnance checks on our flight termination systems. That all went well. That was a critical safety milestone for us. And tomorrow marks the start of our launch countdown. And we'll be working with the same persistence as we've done all along, make sure this rocket is ready. Our number one goal is to make sure that the crew remains safe. That is our highest priority. And that is our unwavering commitment. And we will be there to support the crew until we see boots back on the whale ship. Well deck ship. So with that, I'm going to pass it to Howard.
All right. Thanks, Chris. I am also very excited to be here with you and representing the entire Orion team. You know, we've worked very hard to get to this point. I'll tell you that certainly, you know, we've had our share of work that we need to get done. And when we rolled back to the vehicle assembly building, we powered on, and we didn't have anything that we need to fix. We did top off our launch abort system battery, but there are no issues that we're working to right now. So from our perspective, our spaceship is ready to go and fly Reed, Victor, Jeremy, and Christina to the moon and back. I would say that it's part of normal processing that we have final items that we'd load. For example, the crew's laptop, we're going to have that loaded as part of standard last minute set of hardware that we would get on board. We'll bring forward the batteries for the cameras, et cetera. So nothing unique, very much standard processing that we need to do prepare for the mission. And of course, tomorrow night at around 8 o'clock, our mission evaluation room team, that's the experts that we have to support the flight control team, will be on station and starting the launch countdown process. They'll be ready to go. This MER team is comprised of all the experts across the program from both our U.S. team and our European team, and they work hand-in-hand with our flight control team to make sure that we tackle any issues that might arise during the mission and support the flight control team in terms of decision making and understanding of anything that goes on. So that team is ready to go and really excited and happy to be getting to this point in our launch countdown sequence. Of course, you know, after Chris and SLS team gives us a beautiful ride into space, we've got a lot of things that we're looking forward to in the first 24 hours. We've got a Perigee raise maneuver. We've got a Apogee raise burn. And, of course, we've got our proximity operations demonstration with the ICPS. And it's really awesome time in terms of just from an old guidance navigation control background to see all that happen. And then, of course, along the way during the mission, we're going to be able to check out our first-time systems with the life support systems and our displays and controls. And our MER team, as I said, our mission evaluation room team, will be monitoring and looking at all the data very closely and ensuring that all systems are working before we commit to the moon through our translunar burn. So that's going to be a very important time frame, a very exciting time frame. We're looking forward to seeing what the spacecraft is telling us and operating in that relevant space environment. You know, I would say that, as I said earlier, that the team is certainly poised and ready to support the mission. They're very excited. We've worked many years of testing, verification, validation, and, of course, final checks of the systems over the last several months to ensure that we're ready to go. And on behalf of the entire Orion program team, comprised of experts from the U.S. and from our European partners, we're excited for this mission. We're ready to go. And we look forward to a successful, almost 10-day mission around the moon and back. So thank you.
All right. It's time now for questions. We will start here in the room and then go to the phone. A reminder for those on the phone, you can press star one to get into the question queue. If you don't mind limiting it to one question apiece, and let us know who you'd like to answer that question. And with that, we'll start here in the front row with Marcia Dunn.
Hello, Marcia Dunn, AP, probably for you, Lori. NASA's just rolled out this big moon base plan, and it seems to me that that puts extra pressure, extra attention, so much extra on Artemis II to do well. What's your take on that? I mean, not perfect, but like so much is riding on this mission now that perhaps wasn't before. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, you bet, Marcia. I think there's always been a lot riding on this mission. On Artemis II, we've always recognized from the beginning that the future of the Artemis program, the first major step with crew, is the Artemis II mission. You know, we completed Artemis 1, we demonstrated SLS capabilities, but Artemis 2, where we're really testing out the capabilities of the Orion system, environmental controls, there's always been a lot riding on this mission. But what I can tell you is that the rollout of the moon base plan and the ideas for the accelerated launch cadence, in my opinion, have actually energized our teams. I think our teams are so excited to see an opportunity to not have to wait several years before the next mission. They are, what I see, driven now to how can we work to achieve this amazing launch cadence that allows us to keep our learnings and turn them around quickly and build the muscle memory we've been talking about. So from what I see, it's more of an energizer than anything.
All right, second row, Bill Harwood.
Yeah, Bill Harwood, CBS News for Howard. You know, making the first flight with a complete life support system puts an awful lot on the plate that has to work for that during that first 25 hours before the TLI burn. Can you give us a sense of what gives you confidence that that system is going to work the way you want it to in the environment of space, just based on the testing you've done on the ground and and the legacy systems that are involved? Just overall confidence all that's going to work, right? Because obviously it has to if you're going to go to the moon.
Yeah. So, Bill, I would answer, just like all our primary systems and all the systems on spaceship, we do a lot of testing. Uniquely for life support, we put actually humans with the life support system, both in the cabin environment and also in the spacesuits. And we've been designing the system since the very beginning of the program, and over the last decade plus, we've been doing testing across the board with suits and with the environmental control systems in the cabin and with human subjects. We have a vacuum chamber at Johnson Space Center that allows us to do that. So that's one part of it in terms of the final kind of checkout with people. But along the way, just like any other hardware we do, we test at the individual box level. We test at the harness and connector level, and then we also test an integrated system, you can imagine in a pallet. And of course, we do the spacecraft checkout as well. So there's a varying steps that we take and increase fidelity by which we do this testing. And that testing includes the actual flight software that controls some of the ECLS hardware or life support hardware that we need. So a very robust test campaign comprised of not only just components, integrated systems, and with people.
Okay. We'll come here, second row, Lauren Grush.
Hi, Lauren Grush with Bloomberg. I'm just wondering, do we know at this point the distance that they will come within the moon if they launch on April 1st? How does that change throughout the April window? And if it does change, will they still be breaking the distance record for a human crew? Thanks.
That's a great question. Maybe, I don't know if Howard, do you know the off the top of your head what the distance is?
I'll just quote these numbers because we're doing the math on it right now. 252,799 statue miles on April 1st. So that'll be the farthest point that we're going on the moon. And of course, we're going to be 4,144 statue miles further than the Apollo has ever gone. So in terms of distance, we're working that on the second, third, and fourth. I would say let's launch on the first and go from there, okay? But we are doing the calculations, and if you, Lauren, if you need those numbers, our teams are working on it very hard. Yeah.
Let's go third row.
Hi, thanks for doing this. Lori, you mentioned that there's still a couple of closeout items from the FRR. Can you remind us what those are and where those stand? And then I also wanted to ask about, I mean, we talked about ground forecasts. Really curious about in-space weather forecasts. I know you guys are working with NOAA to kind of crunch those numbers, but they're kind of difficult to predict. Just would love if someone could speak to, you know, how those conversations are going and what you're prepared for if there is, you know, space weather event.
So I'll see if I can remember off the top of my head what the items were. The one thing that we held for, we had one item that had to be closed in time for the L-2, and that item was working with our medical teams, with the chief medical officer, looking at other countries around the world where if we had an emergency abort and we landed in different seas, we needed to use medical facilities that were nearby in some of those other countries. It was working with those countries to assure we have the right agreements in place. And I believe those are getting close to closure. They will be closed by tomorrow. And so that's the intent there. Some of the other items were really a constraint to roll out. And so those have all been closed before we rolled to the pad. I'm trying to remember what they all were, and I can't remember from the top of my head. Sean, you may remember what some of them were.
One of them was our comm systems. We've had some challenges with our comm systems. We've done some configuration changes. We've done some retest, and I think we're in good shape to go.
Yeah, I know we've closed them all out. There was like four items, maybe three in addition to the international piece, and they've all been closed.
Okay, we'll do a couple more here in the room. Let's go with Irene Klotz and then Jeff Faust.
Thanks. Irene Klotz with Aviation Week. For Sean, has a stop work order now been issued for the Mobile Launcher 2? And as far as SLS and Orion, if you're able to each just give a summary of where the hardware status is for the core stage for Artemis 3 and the Orion crew and service module for 3. Thanks.
So we have issued a stop work order for Mobile Launcher 2. We've pivoted the team to begin removing some of the hardware that's common to Mobile Launcher 1 that we can use as critical spares. Some of these items are very long lead items. They're hard to build, and they will be put to good use for future Artemis missions for supporting Mobile Launcher 1.
And from SLS, there's two other parts, right? For SLS, the boosters, the aft segments, are being loaded on the rail cars, and they're ready for shipment. So they'll be here in the first part of April. As you know, the core stage is the engine section for core stage is in High Bay 2 being outfitted. The top four-fifths will be leaving Michoud at the end of April and arriving here. ICPS is already complete and it's on dock here locally. LVSA, OSA are both in storage waiting on the phone call for assembly. So we're in really good shape for Artemis 3.
And from our perspective, you know, we've been making good progress on Artemis III. So on the crew module side, we're wrapping up the final big installation. So the heat shield is going, getting attached to the crew module this month, as well as a side hatch. And then it's going to go through its paces for testing as an individual element, the crew module itself. If you might remember, the European service module arrived last December, making great progress. We finished up thermal cycle testing on that, and we're on plan for the summer to put both the crew module and the service module together.
All right, let's go to Jeff Faust, and then we'll go to several on the phone.
Hi, Jeff Faust of Space News. Just sort of a little bit of a follow-up to that question. We're talking now about doing three more Artemis missions through the end of 2028, rapid increase in the cadence compared to the gap between Artemis 1 and 2. What lessons have you learned in the lead-up to Artemis 2 that you will apply to be able to increase that cadence for Artemis 3, 4, and 5?
Well, I can tell you from a ground processing perspective, we reduced our processing time in the multipurpose processing facility by 50%. That's where we serviced Orion, that's where we fueled it. And in the launch abort systems facility, we reduced the processing time there by 30%. And so, you know, we've already started applying lessons learned from the Artemis 1 flow to Artemis 2, and that's why we're here today. That's why we're able to hold, you know, our February commitment to roll. And as far as getting ready for Artemis 3 is concerned, we are going to be challenged. There's no doubt about it. But our team is energized. They're fired up. They look forward to the increased launch cadence. We'll do, you know, we've already started collecting lessons learned from Artemis 2 processing as well. And, you know, there'll be probably some, you know, we'll probably have to staff up a bit. We'll have to, you know, go to different shifting profiles. We'll have to leverage the Orion folks and the SLS folks during our processing flows to take full advantage of, you know, all the knowledge that we need. And we put that together, and we're going to go for it. We're going to try to meet the administrator's challenge for us.
And from SLS, I will say we're assisting Sean's team more and more through our OEMs here as they do the processing. Before we even get here, we've upped our presence in the supply chain at our sub-tier vendors. We have engineers in the field helping these vendors work through their issues building these critical parts. And then one of the biggest items that's going to help us out is with the new core stage processing that we have in High Bay 2, which is vertical integration. It opens up a lot more work areas that we have. We can work internal in the volumes and external on the vehicle at the same time. As previously, when we built the first one, and the second one, we had mostly horizontal work, right? So this, the vertical assembly in High Bay 2 has been a big enabler for us.
Okay. Yeah, I think from the Orion perspective, you know, even before this announcement, you know, we are very much geared towards trying to build our spaceships faster. So the investments we made over the last couple of years not only increase more infrastructure in the operations checkout facility, which is where we build and put together the Orion spaceship. We increased in the infrastructure there, including ground support equipment, including our gantries, things like that, to enable us to build two spaceships in parallel. And that was already investment. So I think doing that has helped us look forward in terms of meeting the administrator's challenge to get three Orions out the door as quickly as we can to support these missions. I think the other part that very similar to what Chris was talking about, you know, supply chain and our supplier base is very important. Obviously, we have all the hardware for three, but four and five, we're still getting deliveries of hardware, and we need to make sure that cadence is quickly moving forward, providing the hardware we need to build the spaceship. And that's something we're investing a lot of time in, very similar to what Chris described, by being in with the supply chain and helping them where we can. And just like the administrator said, I think it's really important for NASA to engage actively to enable this to happen as quickly as possible to support these missions.
All right, we'll go to several questions on the phone. The first one will be from Joey Roulette with Reuters.
Hey, thanks. Question for Howard or Lori. On the last call with the astronauts, we were talking about the docking, or not docking, the manual control test with Orion. And I was wondering for Artemis 3 if the ProxOps is going to need to be manual or autonomous or a little bit of both. How is that going to play out for that mission? Thanks.
I'll take the first part, and then we'll kind of hand it over to Howard if he has more detail. I will tell you that our teams are actively working right now to really better understand the mission profile for Artemis III. We know our primary goal is to demonstrate rendezvous and docking with one or both of the human landing system landers. I expect details of exactly what those look like will be developed over the next month and maybe a little beyond that as we really refine what those operations look like. The key goal, honestly, with Artemis III, first off, will be to coordinate the launches and rendezvous. That's going to be a big challenge in and of itself. Then the actual rendezvous operations and the proximity operations, I imagine, will be fairly similar to what we're trying to do with Artemis II, but we'll need to do that carefully, and then the docking maneuver. So I'll hand it over to Howard if you want to say more detail about what you anticipate those docking procedures to look like.
Yeah, I could probably take up the rest of the time talking about my favorite topic of rendezvous, prox ops, and docking. But I'll say very shortly, Ryan, we've always been designed and we developed for autonomous capability all the way to docking, so the crew does not need to take over in a manual way. But in the heritage of the shuttle program, where the crew members would take the stick and fly what we call being on the docking axis, so they're right aligned with where the docking mechanism and where the hatches are, and depends on the distance. I can't remember the shuttle time, but for us, it will be something we'll talk with the flight operations team and the crew, whether they would take the stick and finish the final approach and docking, the physical docking, or not. So that's important discussion, but more importantly, just like anything else, you know, we want to make sure we understand our manual capabilities. And so the Artemis II demonstration gives the crew an opportunity to really, I would say, test drive the car. They get a chance to really get a sense of the feedback through the system of how the spacecraft performs. And that's going to be really important. And whether they need to or not for Artemis III, that's we can decide that later. But to characterize that, to understand that capability and what the spaceship can do and perform and the response that it would provide is really important. And I think demonstrating that Artemis II will definitely give us a great understanding and buy down risk as we move forward to Artemis III and beyond.
The next question is from Will Robinson-Smith with Spaceflight Now.
Thank you for taking the time to speak with us today. Question for Howard Hugh, if I may. We heard from Christina earlier today during the crew briefing about the limitations of the suits as it relates to abort scenarios. But can you go into some detail and talk about, once you get beyond the TLI burn, specifically, what are the abort options for Orion if you need to make a maneuver that doesn't get you all the way out to the moon but is more of a U-turn back before then? And then just briefly, what is the abort region weather looking like right now for a launch on the first? Thanks.
Okay, I'll answer the first question. I don't know about the abort weather, so maybe I'll turn to Sean to help me with that. We have a very capable abort coverage. You might hear a lot about the ascent piece, but I think you're talking about post-TLI or translunar injection burn that we would do. What we call those is, I would say, less aborts, but early return. And what you would do as we move out post-TLI, we have a capability to return back to Earth at any along any point of the trajectory. And it's different types of burns. Certainly early in the mission, I think the first 36 hours or so, we'll probably do what I call turn and burn, which is you would not go to the moon if there was an emergency, a significant emergency, which we would have to bring the crew home immediately. We would do that burn, execute that burn, and we've already done all the calculations. We know what we need to do, and so the crew come home safely. After that, it's probably safer at times to, from a time perspective, to fly around the moon and come back and take that free return trajectory. You're not getting any more time savings, and you don't have to do another big burn. You're already on that path forward to hitting our entry corridor. And so I think that's where we will make a decision as a mission management team to determine how best to move forward. But we do have a continuous early return capability that we've already run hundreds of thousands of trajectories against and ensured that we are able to get the crew home safely.
Yep. As far as launch abort weather is concerned, it's currently forecast as go on Thursday. We have three types of aborts that we could do right after launch. One is called a LAS abort, a launch abort system abort, where the spacecraft would land, fairly close to the launch site, and then a untargeted Atlantic abort, which would land somewhere across the Atlantic near Africa, and then abort once around possibility if we went into a single orbit and then come back down near our nominal landing site in San Diego. Our recovery forces are gathering as we speak out in San Diego. All the equipment that we're going to use for recovery is being loaded on the ship as we speak, and we're ready to go as far as our abort scenarios are concerned.
Our next question is from Christopher Mick with the Hudson Star Observer.
Thank you all for doing this today. I guess my question kind of follows up onto what was just mentioned. I know you don't have everything available at this time, but if the launch were to happen at the beginning of the two-hour launch window on April 1st, can you talk about what approximately the splashdown time would be off San Diego?
Ooh, I don't have that.
We can follow up with you.
We'll follow
that.
Up.
Absolutely.
Once we do that TLI burn, it's set, but yeah. We'll find it for you.
Okay, let's go back to several more here in the room. We'll come on this side here in the front row.
Hi, Josh Dinner, space.com. Are there any even minor technical issues or risk assessments that are still open that may pose a potential of pushing the launch into any, by a few days into this window?
I mean, I'm going to jump in. You're looking at Sean shake his head no there. There's, little things that we find as we go that we're working right there, but none of them are threatening the first right now.
Yep, I would agree. I mean, we had a minor issue on our flare stack where one of our pilot lights don't work. We have three of them. One of them doesn't work. We're going to fix it tomorrow. But that's the kind of stuff we're talking about right now. And I'll take that any day.
Yeah. And the vehicle's quiet. We're not working anything.
Yeah, we don't have any issues with working, like I said.
Okay. We'll come to Phillip Sloss.
Hi, Phillip Sloss. I think this is for Chris. Just following up on questions from Irene and earlier, it sounds like there's a lot of SLS hardware for Artemis III that's going to be coming to the Cape here this month, April. I had one follow-up on that, which was when the four-fifths gets here, is the engine section going to be ready to do that final mate with it?
It's there is some work still to be done when it gets here. It's not like it rolls in and lifts up. So there's a little bit of work that has to be done. But it's all part of the plan, but it's ready, and based on our assessment last week, right, we looked at where everything was in the supply chain and the work that's being completed. When Sean's going to need it, we're going to have it ready for him when it's time to hang it on the boosters. We'll be ready to go.
Okay, we'll stick here with the room.
Thank you. Manuel Masanti with Exploración Espacial. Did anyone, or did the CubeSats on board the mission need any kind of servicing, or they're fine, ready to go?
Yeah, I can tell you we are carrying four CubeSats, four payloads, secondary payloads from our international partners, four different international partners. We have one from Argentina, Germany, South Korea, and Saudi Arabia. Thank you. And I think only one of them required a top off on their battery. The others were fine. They didn't need any work. The fourth one, the battery was topped off, and it's fine. So they're all in very good shape, ready for launch.
Okay. We'll go here to Ken.
Hi, Ken Kramer. Thank you. Thanks for this update, and good luck with everything. Howard, let me ask you, can you describe the proxops in a lot greater detail than what we've heard? And I want to know how close it will be to, like, when you would do the human landing system docking on Artemis III. I guess it's going to be informed there, but can you go into how much? And what are we going to see in real time? You're going to have video of this proxop demonstration? Thanks.
Yeah, I don't know about the video part, but I'll just give you some quick highlights. We separate from the upper stage, and then we'll go out probably about 100 meters. So we'll flip over, and then we'll start doing the approach. and the approach will be all the way to about 10 meters, so about 30 some feet. And so the crew will be manually piloting along the way. There's specific things, tasks that they're going to be doing. And it's going to be very exciting, I think, to just not only because of new spacecraft, but something that we will play forward in terms of what their ability, like I said earlier. And so that demonstration, then there's a second part, which we back away again and do a hold. And then actually the ICPS slews over, and then we do another process, other reflectors on the side of the ICPS that we're using to dock or to reflect from and to get understanding how that would work in terms of visualization from our docking camera. And so those things will be very important for us to understand the close-in approach. Now, rendezvous proximate docking is thousands of miles, right, starting at a very far away. So you're getting very close in terms of what the final sets of our ability to do prox ops and demonstration for final mission. But there's a lot of work prior to that. Obviously, we can't do that. Now, we will do some long-range bearing. We have a bearing camera, as we depart from ICPS and capture all that data as we go forward. So the equipment that we need to understand the environment that we're going to be under and what we would get is really important to capture for this mission. But certainly there's still a good amount of work remain to do to enable for us to do the entire rendezvous prox ops and docking scenario.
And Ken, to your question about what you can expect to see, we do expect the public will be able to see the same view from the docking camera that the crew is seeing. So we'll be able to show you that if all's going well.
Oh, that's going to be exciting.
Mm-hmm. Okay, our next question, we're going to go back to the phone. This is from Claire Cameron with Scientific American.
Hi there. Thanks so much for doing this. I did want to ask again about the potential for space weather and how you are sort of planning for that and whether that could have some impact on launch date. Thanks.
I believe I saw a note this morning that says right now we're not watching anything. In the weather report we got today, it said the space weather risk was low, but we can look and see if we can get you additional detail. But that's right now we're not keeping an eye on anything.
Okay, our next question is from David Denault with About Space Today News.
My question is for Howard. This morning, there was two comments made about how Orion might be performing. The first one, I believe it was Commander Reed, who said something about having the addition of the life support system might have an effect on how the spacecraft might operate. And the second one I found interesting was about exercising inside the spacecraft and how that might affect the Orion spacecraft's operations. Could you comment on those two, please?
Yeah, you bet. The first one, the way we get rid of carbon dioxide is we vent it out of the spaceship. So we have a component called the CO2 humidity control box, and that box absorbs the CO2 that comes out of human beings, and then we dump it overboard, and that's venting. And you can imagine, if you're anywhere a physics student, you can imagine that when you impart a force on the vehicle, whether it's venting or anything else, you got to counteract that force. And so that's what we talk about when we talk about the ecosystem imparting some things on the spaceship. So we have to correct that. We have a very robust attitude control system, closed loop. And so it'll adjust to any of those situations. And we could swing this CHC or the CO2 humidity control system 15 minutes, 30 minutes, however we want, based on what we need, how much CO2 we need to remove. And so this is going to be an important understanding of how the spacecraft controls our attitude of the vehicle and make sure that it responds to this venting environment. So that's one piece. And then the second thing is very related as well. We have a flywheel. That's our exercise device. Think about, it's not exactly a rower. If you go to the gym, it's more than that. But you can see as in a rowing kind of motion, which is what they're going to be doing in space, you can see that there's dynamics involved in terms of the forces that are being applied from that motion. And those forces have to be counteract from a spaceship perspective as well. So our jets, our reaction control jets, will be augmenting or dissipating any of those things. So that's going to be really interesting test as well. We're going to try to, I think, cycle through each crew member 30 minutes of exercise a day is, I think, our plan still. And then we'll have a lot of understanding of the dynamics. And it's really important that, obviously, as we go into deep space, that the human body gets to exercise. And we're learning a lot on this mission beyond what we have in space station. Space station has a lot of great exercise equipment. You can't put all the treadmills and things like that on our spaceship. And so this flywheel is a really great exercise tool that we're learning from and utilizing as we go forward.
All right, we'll take one more question from the phone, and then we'll come back into the room here. Our next question is from TJ Mascaro with the Epoch Times.
Good afternoon. Thank you all so much. Question for Lori and Howard. When we were talking to the astronauts, they mentioned an eclipse event if they launched on April 1st and 2nd. Can you all talk a little bit more about that, what you're expecting and preparing for?
Sure. So I'll speak to it from kind of the exciting science part of it, and then Howard can speak to it from the Orion performance side of it. I think it's going to be very interesting in this flight if we are able to launch on the 1st. The crew are going to get to have some pretty interesting eclipse opportunity to be able to look back at the disk of the moon with the sun being in eclipse. And I think from a science perspective, they'll be able to see the sun's corona. And I think it'll be really fascinating and a great kind of observation opportunity for the crew there. It's kind of I think going to be a unique thing on this one. Go ahead, Howard, you want to speak to the...
Yeah, I think, I get questioned a lot. When are we launching? Why is this day in? This day is out. There's a lot of several factors, obviously, but power is one of the analysis that we do to screen for eclipses. We know where the eclipses are happening. And we want to make sure we're power positive is what we use the word for. And so when we screen across multiple trajectories, multiple days, every minute of the launch period, by the way, to ensure that we have significant power positive margins, when we enter into a eclipse, and then making sure that there's not other segmented eclipses that could happen, so we have time to recharge our batteries. And so when we do that, we run hundreds of thousands of trajectories per each launch period. And so I think many of you ask, when can we launch? A lot of that work across multiple launch periods are being done by a really great team. And we look at all the power and any abort cases as well. Also, when we have abort trajectories, we will also have eclipses. So for both nominal and abort, for the April 1st to the 6th, we've got power positive margin. And so that's why we can say that we can fly these missions with confidence.
All right, we'll come back into the room. Let's go over here to Marcia, and then we'll come to Josh.
Marcia Dunn, AP again. Lori, I've heard you say you're figuring on four real true attempts in 6 days. How do you figure that? And a countdown question, if it's just the weather and the rocket's sitting on the pad for 2 hours and doesn't go, if it's just weather, can you turn that around in 24 hours and try the next day?
So I'm going to talk to just a little bit, and then I'm going to hand it to Sean because he can probably give you more detail. So we have 6 days that each of those 6 days, the 1st through the 6th, are viable launch days. But we do need to, if we do a scrub, there's at least 24 hours to turn around. And in some cases, we need to replenish some of the gases and things that we need to fuel the spacecraft and run the spacecraft. So those sometimes we'll need to do a 48-hour scrub. So if you take the 6 days that we have available, if some of those are 24 opportunities and some of them are 48-hour scrubs, we think we can get up to four launch attempts within that six-day period. Sean can speak more to the resources that are required and what drive the 24 versus 48.
Yeah, as part of getting ready for Artemis II, we actually installed a new 1.4 million gallon hydrogen dewar. And so that enables us the four launch attempts that Lori referred to. Whether it's a 24-hour scrub or a 48-hour scrub really depends on the reason. You know, it depends on what the hardware problem was, or when we scrub in the launch countdown. So if we're real late, that means we're using more hydrogen. We're bleeding off more hydrogen. If we scrub early, we're not bleeding off as much. But we're prepared for a 24. Hour scrub turnaround for just about any case.
So if it's purely weather.
Yeah, if it's purely weather, we can hit a 24 hour.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we'll come here. Let's wait for Mike to come around. Yep.
Hi, Josh Dinner, space.com again. Howard, this one's for you. You mentioned Orion's attitude control system, and I know there's a demonstration of the two different attitude control modes during the mission. Can you talk about the differences between the 6-degree and 3-degree of freedom configurations and which scenarios both of them are sort of advantageous over the other to be used?
Yeah, wow, that's a very good question. I wasn't expecting that. Okay, so going to back to guidance, navigation, control. So 6-degree of freedom allows you to obviously do X, Y, and Z and translate as well. So for us, we're always in the 6-degree of freedom configuration. That gives us the fine control. If we needed to, we'd go to a 3-DOF to clean or 3 degrees of freedom to clean it up if necessary based on the RCS configuration. But in general, and then we're going to do a test of both, right? Our ability to control the spacecraft is really important, and our ability to have a closed-loop control system that allows us to do both, and a jet selection logic along with that. So we have multiple jets that we can use to fire together in combination is really important as well. So all those things are part of our, I guess, that the answer is yes, we're going to do both. Yes, they're very important, but in general, 6-degree of freedom is the control mode that we would generally want to be in.
Okay, we'll go to one on the phone. We have Micah Maidenberg with the Wall Street Journal.
Hey, thanks, Rachel. Maybe for Lori, could you remind me just about the role of the prime contractors at this point, specific to SLS and Orion? Like, are folks from the companies actively working with NASA teams right into launch, or is it more they're on standby if something comes up? Some color there would be great. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you for the question, Micah. In fact, I'm really excited to answer this one. We are still working very, very closely with all of our prime contractors. In fact, the issue that we had that required us to roll back to the VAB, the helium quick disconnect connection there, was a great example that showed our NASA teams and our contractor teams from Boeing and ULA and from our ground system contractor teams and our NASA teams all working together as one team. It was fantastic, and it's great to see we're just trying to solve the problems and get the work done. So we are working really closely with our contractors, all the contractors and the NASA folks, including the folks from Boeing, Lockheed, ULA, Northrop Grumman. We're all in there together, and there's more as well, but we're all in there together. And when we get questions about how are we going to turn around faster and be able to implement the accelerated plan that the administrators rolled out for Artemis 3, 4, 5, and beyond, I think this is the way we're going to work together in the future much more closely and more integrated and more collaboratively with these integrated teams. So it's been a great demonstration here.
Okay, let's go on this side to Lauren Grush again.
Hi, thanks for taking a second question. I'm just curious, what, if any, flexibility do you have with the biggest maneuvers that you have planned in space? For instance, if a burn doesn't happen exactly at the right time, is there any wiggle room, or are there just some maneuvers that have to go off as planned and or else they can't happen? Thank you.
Maybe that's, you want me to take that one?
Yeah, why don't you take that, Howard?
So all our burns that are on Orion's side, obviously including the translunar injection burn, we have a recovery plan. So two things could happen. One, if your main engine cuts out, so we have our auxiliary engines that would go forward. We also could also do a replan of that and continue that burn as well. So that's there. We certainly have covered all the other burns. There's one burn that's we call critical that must be done. It's our return trajectory correction burn 3, RTC 3. It's about 5 hours before we hit entry interface. That really corrects and makes sure we hit that corridor, which is really important, obviously, for making sure we can get the crew home safely through the Earth entry point. And so that's our only burn that is critical. The rest we can replan, I would say, and clean up as necessary if we do not get a full burn off.
Okay, let's go to Bill Harwood next.
For Mr. Quinn, I'm a little confused on the recycle options. I thought if you gassed it up and got late in the window, you couldn't do a 24-hour turnaround. That it's some limit that, if you put fuel on board, that affects when you can go again. I just wanted to clarify that.
That was true for Artemis 1. It's not true for Artemis 2. You know, we've got the 1.4 million gallon sphere that gives us a much more significant hydrogen storage capability at the launch site.
You can go later in the window and still
decide. Yeah, I believe so. I mean, I'll confirm, but I believe so. Yeah.
Are we next?
I also had another countdown question. Is there a point in the count where if you hold or for weather or technical issue that you no longer have the whole 2 hours? Like if you get into terminal count, is it commit? I mean, are you able to stop and retarget later in the window, or do you lose some options at some point in the countdown?
Yeah, we can recycle about T minus 5 minutes. If we hold a count before T minus 5 minutes, we can recycle back and try for another attempt.
Okay, we'll take another one on the phone from Will Robinson Smith with Spaceflight Now.
Hi, thanks Rachel for allowing another one. Question to I suppose whoever wants to take it, maybe Sean. If the ICPS isn't able to get Orion into the high Earth orbit, but the Orion module, both crew and service, are working just fine, what would a low Earth orbit version of Artemis II look like? About how long would that last, and what operations could you accomplish in that scenario? Thanks.
Probably a question for Howard, I think.
So we also have what we call alternate mission scenarios, by which we allow ourselves to potentially do a circular orbit. We have a couple options to circularize and execute as much of the objectives that we can. If there's something that happens where we could not get the upper stage to get us a nice burn. So there is various options we looked at. We're able to do some of those mission completion things, and it depends on where we get dropped off, what happens. So it depends on the scenario we're in, but we're definitely ready for those types of scenarios as well. And the flight control team knows what to do. We've already done the planning for that. We've already assessed a lot of those trajectories to make sure that we're ready to go and have them in hand if necessary.
Okay. We'll go actually back there to Miles Doran.
Doran, CBS News. Question for Howard. I know the main engine is used for the TLI burn. Which engines are used for the other burns, the OTC burns, the RTC burns? Is it all the auxiliary thrusters, or can you use both? What's the plan?
The ohms burn is too much. We don't expect to make that correction. Our navigation state should be very good unless something happens along the way and we can't. So all of them are planned to be on the what you call auxiliary or aux burns. If they're small enough, we might even do in the reaction control system on the service module as well. So that'll depend on, you know, what as we approach each OTC, each RTC, which is outbound trajectory correction and then return trajectory corrections, we'll determine how best to utilize our thrusters. But yes, in general, it'll be the auxiliary engines.
Okay, let's go to Ken here in the front.
Thank you. Thanks for our second question. Ken Kramer, Space Up Close. Howard, what is the width of the reentry corridor? I don't know if I've heard a number. And I would also like to get an update on the RS-25 engines. You've got to build new ones for Artemis V. We haven't heard a lot about it. So what is the status? Because if you're going to launch Artemis V in 2 years, you got to get them built and tested pretty soon. Thanks.
Yeah, when you say width, I'll have to get back with you on what you're asking. You mean the width of the corridor in terms of cross range. Is that correct? The cross range. We got range downrange track of up to 1775.
Well, I think even as they approach, right, there's a corridor width before they get there.
Yeah, I'll have to get you that number. Sorry, I don't remember off the top of my head on that one. Okay.
Because astronauts are real concerned about that.
Yeah, it's... Yeah, I can probably delve into more of it, but we'll get you that number. Okay.
Okay, and on the RS-25, right, for Artemis V, they are in production flight set. So we've all completed our acceptance hot firing on two of those new engines already. So they are in the production phase, and we're working through it. You'll go back. You can pull some of the burns and the test from Stennis when we went through those tests of those new engines. So they're in play and they would do support.
All right, and with that, we'll go ahead and wrap up. I want to thank our participants very much for being here today. We will provide another status update tomorrow on how the countdown is going as it gets underway. That'll be at approximately 5 p.m. Eastern time tomorrow. As always, you can follow the latest news and mission events and our progress on NASA.gov. Thank you for joining us.